and the kind of person who pays attention to something as small as the Cricut shipping label. In hindsight, I see that it's those small things that can make or break a business. My adopted political ideals had let me approach money with an elevated level of distaste. I saw it as a materialistic pursuit for materialistic people, but what I have realized over time is that in many ways, money spells freedom. If you learn to control your finances, you won't find yourself stuck in jobs, places, or relationships that you hate just because you can't afford to go elsewhere. Learning how to manage your money is one of the most important things you'll ever do. Being in a good spot financially can open up so many doors. Being in a bad spot can slam them in your face. And being broke gets old, so start making smart decisions now to avoid paying for stupid ones later. Credit cards blow. I wasn't always stealing stuff. Sometimes I went the conventional route when I wanted something. I went to a store and, you know, paid for it. And it was on one of these crazy such occasions that I managed to make a legitimate purchase and ruin my credit in one fell swoop. I was 19 and at the mall buying a bra at Victoria's Secret, because while it's possible to dumpster dive for food and trawl the Salvation Army for clothes, even a freegan knows to invest in new underwear. At the register, the salesperson asked me if I wanted to sign up for a Victoria's Secret card, and I said yes. I thought I was signing up for a rewards program where I'd earn points toward a free bra or something. What I failed to realize at that moment was that I had unknowingly been bestowed my very first credit card. Because I moved so much, I rarely had a steady address, causing bills to miss me as I jumped from state to state. By the time my $28 lingerie charge caught up with me, my credit was wrecked, and I had learned the hard way that you can ruin your credit in one seemingly responsible afternoon, but rebuilding it takes years. When people write about Nasty Gal, the articles almost always note how I built the company with no debt, because that's a pretty unusual feat in the business world. And yes, once I finally got a job and started working for my money, I was extremely responsible with it. But what these stories usually leave out is that it wasn't by choice that I built the company debt-free. It simply wasn't an option because no one would give me a credit card, never mind a business loan. This was frustrating. However, it was also a blessing in disguise. As I had no financial cushion to support me while the business ramped up, I had to bust my ass and make it profitable from day one. In the end, this meant that I grew Nasty Gal to $28 million in revenue without borrowing a dime. But I've also had to accept that credit is not something you can ignore. While I don't agree that the world should reward people for spending money they don't have, it happens to be the way things work. You can only ignore this fact for so long before it returns to bite you in the ass. Like my A-cup bra did for me, it is the little things that can and will wreck your credit. As distasteful as it may seem when you're busy plotting to take over the world, it's equally important to stay on top of your bills. Parking tickets can end up costing you thousands of dollars and court dates. You could suddenly find the apartment of your dreams only to be denied because of that goddamn Target card you signed up for and forgot about while buying a mop, a sports bra, and mayonnaise. When you take care of the little things, you'll be pleasantly surprised to find out that the big things often happen much more easily. Shared living situations are also a blueprint for financial disaster, so try to spread the utility love among your roommates rather than volunteering to have all the bills in your name. Better yet, if you're worried someone might not pull her weight, don't live with that person. Living in the party house is a blast until the party's over and you've got an $800 gas bill and your roommates, who are like your best friends and you guys are gonna know each other forever, are suddenly MIA. Bills, sadly, are not an ignore it and it goes away problem. If you've been getting an overdue notice from the cable company every 2 weeks for the last 3 months, and all of a sudden it stops coming, that does not mean they've gotten over you and moved on to someone else. Big companies are like the mob. They never forget, they never give up, and they always get their money. Get them before they get you. Pay up and pay on time. Cash is king. Money is a guarantee that we may have what we want in the future. Though we need nothing at the moment, it ensures the possibility of satisfying a new desire when it arises. Aristotle. When my parents pulled me out of Catholic school in fourth grade, I thought they were doing so because they were the coolest parents in the world, rescuing me from the tortures of being misunderstood. When they filed for bankruptcy shortly thereafter, I realized the reason I wasn't going to Catholic school anymore wasn't because I didn't want to go, but because my parents couldn't afford for me to go. I vividly remember going with my mom and dad to the credit counselor's office and watching them slice their credit cards into a jar filled to the brim with the shards of other people's bad financial decisions. From that point on, my dad preached a mantra of cash is king, and that has always stuck with me. It's so simple, yet so difficult for a lot of people to understand. Do not spend more money than you have. Sadly, doing just that is not only the norm for a lot of people, but also a signifier of success. Growing up in the suburbs, I saw it all the time. The flaunted backyard pool or new monster truck. These things often weren't a sign of what these people could afford, but only of what they could borrow. For the obvious reasons detailed in the previous chapters, my parents cut me off financially when it became apparent that school and work weren't my top priorities. I now know that it was a tough decision for them to make, especially at a time when I wasn't inspiring confidence in my ability to take care of myself. And it was even tougher for me to take. I had friends who were supported by their parents, and I was totally envious. It seemed unfair to me that some kids were able to do whatever they wanted, while I spent my afternoons at a costume shop, helping burners find their goggles and stupid hats for Burning Man. However, forcing me to figure out how to provide for myself was probably one of the best things my parents ever did for me. I come from a long line of hustlers. My dad has worked in home loans for as long as I've been alive. My mom sold houses before becoming a writer, and they have both worked entirely on commission since before I was born. In short, how much money they brought home was a direct result of how hard and how smart they worked. Sometimes we rented single-story houses. Sometimes we owned two-story houses. My dad always said, "You're only as good as your next month." And in Nasty Gal's early days, that was how I lived as well. No matter what, I had to get my options listed. Otherwise, I was devoid of dinero. When Nasty Gal first opened, I had little to no overhead aside from my sweat, daily, tears, regularly, and blood. Sometimes vintage has sharp things hiding in it. In 2010, after Nasty Gal moved off eBay and was a full-fledged business, I had almost $1 million cash in the bank. When sales spiked around the holiday season, I kept taking screenshots every time the account balance would go up because I never knew if I'd see more money than that in one place at one time ever again. I wanted to remember what that many zeros looked like forever. Another big no-no is increasing your spending as soon as your income increases. I have always been careful to avoid this pitfall. For a long time, I was so focused on growing the business that spending money on myself didn't even cross my mind. Even if I had wanted to drop $500 on a pair of shoes, I was just too busy. Girl boss, when your time spent making money is significantly greater than your time spent spending money, you will be amazed at how much you can save without even really thinking about it. Though today I would prefer to look back and call myself practical and resourceful, the truth is that in the early days of the business, I was a total Scrooge. If we absolutely needed something, I bought it. But if it was just nice to have, I didn't. When we finally went to IKEA and bought desks, it felt like a shopping spree to my inner anarchist, who was growing ever quieter as the years went by. Who knew that we could have built desks with a free door and some milk crates from Craigslist? But as Nasty Gal hired up a storm and became a real business, we had to act like a real office. In 2011, I took my first vacation since starting the company and went to Hawaii by myself. It was heaven, and I extended my trip from a week to a week and a half. At the time, we were in the process of moving Nasty Gal from Emeryville to Los Angeles. And when I returned from Hawaii in a state of semi-nirvana after spending 11 days in paradise, I found out that someone had ordered brand new Herman Miller Aeron chairs for the entire office. At that point, yes, IKEA desks were totally necessary. Aeron chairs, however, were not. I happened to have a Herman Miller Aeron chair in my office. To me, it was a rite of passage. But I bought my chair with my money, not Nasty Gal's. And you want to know where I got it? You guessed it. used on Craigslist. There was no way that I was going to have interns rolling around on these things. It sent the wrong message to the company to preach frugality while balling out on 12 grand worth of chairs. You can't act like you've arrived when you're only just receiving the invitation. We couldn't return the Aeron chairs, but after we were settled in our new LA offices, our poor office manager, Francis, spent 6 months selling them on Craigslist. In the eBay days, when vintage was selling for 10 times what I paid for it, it felt like I was printing money. But instead of buying out the bar or heading to Prada, I started saving, investing every cent back into the business. As much as I liked the shoes I could afford, I liked having the money more. Nasty Gal didn't have a budget until 2010 because we didn't need one. I always knew how much cash was in the bank and designated chunks to spend on buying trips, ensuring that there was always a healthy cushion for the business. As uneducated buyers, we bought much the same as anyone who had a small business would. Okay, so we bought 12 of that dress last week and it sold out, so maybe this week we'll buy 24? We trusted our instincts and stuck to the two tenets of my philosophy. Sell things for more than you pay for them, and save more than you spend. Simple, yes, but that is the philosophy that ultimately led to a really big business. One of the best books I've read was George S. Klassen's The Richest Man in Babylon, which offers financial advice in a collection of parables. My ex-boyfriend read it, and it kicked him in the butt enough that he got himself out of debt and went on to save thousands of dollars. The average American only saves 6.5% of his or her income, which is barely keeping up with inflation. But you, dear girl boss, should save 10% at the bare minimum. I know it's a lot easier to talk about saving money than it is to actually save it. Here's a tip. Treat your savings account like just another bill. It has to be paid every month, or there are consequences. If you have direct deposit, have a portion of your paycheck automatically diverted into a savings account. Once it's in there, forget about it. You never saw it anyway. It's an emergency fund only, and vacations are not emergencies. If you're tempted to buy something, just imagine that those new shoes were actually made out of crisp $20 bills. Do those $20 bills look good getting dirty on the sidewalk? No, they do not. That's because money looks better in the bank than on your feet. The art of the ask. To many people, talking about money is awkward. They think they have either too little or too much. As you now know, I'm pretty shameless, so from haggling the price of a sweater to negotiating with investors, talking about money doesn't bother me. Once, when looking for an apartment, a landlord insisted on keeping my non-refundable credit check fee even after I told him not to run my credit. I had called him 5 minutes after submitting my application to make sure of that. So I fought it. On the phone, something came over me. My voice got low and threatening, and I growled, $50 means a lot more to me than it does to you, and I have all the time in the world to get it back. I meant it, and he knew it, saying that I was unemployed. And guess what? I got my money back. A friend and I once stuck our thumbs out in a half-serious attempt to hitchhike on a Greyhound bus. Lo and behold, the bus stopped, the door opened, and we climbed on. Wet with rain, we were met with faces of equal disbelief among our fellow passengers. You don't get what you don't ask for. You're in luck, girl boss, as this mantra applies even better to money than it does to Greyhound buses. Some people may say that I was a horrible person for haggling at a thrift store, but I was just another person trying to get by. By the end of the week, those seemingly insignificant tiny discounts had made a material difference, and I could put the money I'd saved towards something else in the business. If you're frustrated because you're not getting what you want, stop for a second. Have you actually flat out asked for it? If you haven't, stop complaining. You can't expect the world to read your mind. You have to put it out there, and sometimes putting it out there is as simple as just saying, "Hey, can I have that?" That being said, if you don't like talking about money, I get it. There are ways to make the whole thing less traumatic. The first piece of advice I can give you is to learn to separate your money from your emotions as much as you possibly can. Whether someone is asking you for money, you're asking someone else, or you're contemplating a significant purchase, approaching financial decisions as calmly and as rationally as possible will make everything a whole lot easier. It also quite literally pays to be as unemotional as possible when you're asking for a raise. First, be really honest with yourself and make sure that you deserve the raise that you're asking for. You do not automatically deserve a raise just because you've been somewhere for a certain amount of time. But if you can articulate the reasons why you deserve a pay increase, then schedule time to meet with your boss and let her know in advance what you want to talk about. This can be as simple as, "I'd like to schedule some time with you to talk about my salary. Is it okay if we put something on the calendar?" Talk to your boss about this in person. Hitting him up on GChat is not appropriate. If your company does regular yearly reviews, that can also be your chance to talk about money. When you do meet to discuss it, skip the personal sob stories. The only factor that affects your chance of getting a raise is whether or not you've earned it. It doesn't matter if your car broke down or that your landlord's raising your rent. Those facts are not your boss's problem. All she needs to know is that you're kicking ass, like a girl boss should. Put that money to work. While I still don't blow my money, I am now comfortable with buying expensive stuff. It is natural at some point to realize that it's worth it to spend a little extra, if you can afford it, to get something that's just right. This is true when it comes to buying clothes, and it's true when hiring employees. Sometimes it pays to spend a little more than you bargain for on real quality. Spend money because it's an investment in your own well-being, not because you're bored and have nothing else to do. Don't get all Versace, Versace, Versace and buy things just because you can. Luxury can be a great experience, and the things around you should represent the life that you've made for yourself, as long as you're taking the time to appreciate those items. I bought silverware recently, and when I was eating my yogurt this morning, I couldn't help but think, this spoon is serious. Don't live like a CEO when you're still a sandwich artist. The first car I bought after the Volvo wasn't a Porsche. It was a used Nissan Murano. I loved this car. I put half down, around $10,000, financed the rest with an 11% interest rate, my first loan, and was so excited about the horrible deal I had just gotten that I hugged the car salesman when he handed me the keys. I paid it off in full within the next year. Last year, I decided it was time to upgrade. One great thing about Los Angeles is that you can get away with being flamboyant with little consequence. It's a car-centric city, where driving can be a rush hour hell or a hedonistic romp. Cruising down Sunset Boulevard with the cramps blasting and palm trees silhouetted by the neon signs of strip clubs can sometimes repair the worst of my moods. When I went to buy the Porsche, I was ready to splurge. But me being me, I wanted to again put half down. The dealership, however, put a kink in my well-laid plans for a financially responsible splurge. They wouldn't give me a loan or a lease. Who would have guessed that Porsche had stingier financing than Nissan? And as it turned out, even though I was now running my own company and had enough money to put down a hefty deposit, my credit was still only mediocre. It was a WTF moment that drove home to me how screwy the credit system is. I was reminded again that the common way is not always the best way. Therefore, I paid cash for that Porsche. A girl boss has got to do what a girl boss has got to do. This time, when I got my keys, nobody got a hug. And no, it wasn't because I was bitter about the financing. It's that buying the Porsche and all of its German-engineered perfection just wasn't as special. Nothing will ever compare to the first time I bought myself a car, because it simply can't be done again. Treat your mind like your money. Don't waste it. Chapter 6. Hocus Pocus, the Power of Magical Thinking. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Aleister Crowley. I hate the concept of luck, especially when people try to apply it to me. Yes, it's true. Hundreds of thousands of businesses fail. Mine succeeded. Was all that just because I got lucky? I don't really think so. What I hate about luck is that it implies being devoid of responsibility. It implies that you can do nothing and then step into success as easily as stepping into a pile of dog poop on the sidewalk. It implies that success is something given to a knighted and often undeserving few. Luck tells us that we don't control our own fate, and that our path to success or failure is written by someone or something entirely outside ourselves. Luck lets us believe that whatever happens, whether good or bad, it's not to our credit or our fault. That is why I don't buy luck. But I do buy magic. I'm a member of the Magic Castle, which is a private magician's club housed in an old Victorian mansion in the Hollywood Hills. Its floors are carpeted, its waiters tuxedoed, and its drinks strong. Quite often, my boyfriend and I are the youngest ones there, but in my mind, there's no better or more glamorous place to spend a Saturday night, all dressed up with a champagne cocktail in hand, watching an aging showgirl do a tap dance shuffle on stage while a man works the crowd with a dove in one pocket and a few card tricks in the other. There's that kind of magic for sure. But there's also the everyday kind of magic that we make for ourselves. And that's not really magic at all. It's just recognizing the fact that we control our thoughts and our thoughts control our lives. This is an extremely simple, totally straightforward concept, but for a lot of people, it's so alien that it might as well be magic. Chances are that you know someone who is really negative. You know the type. Always complaining, getting fired, having her car broken into, his girlfriend is cheating on him. These people are convinced that life is shit. And so it is. It's the age-old concept of like attracts like, or the law of attraction. You get back what you put out. So you might as well think positively, focus on visualizing what you want instead of getting distracted by what you don't want, and send the universe your good intentions so that it can send them right back. The success of Nasty Gal has been a wild and fast ride, and I'm not going to lie, there were times when that ride has been absolutely terrifying. But for about the first year after the business really started to take off, I felt like a lamb being led to slaughter. We were hiring like crazy, and getting tons of attention from press and starting to get noticed by investors. Every day I got up, went to work, and got hit in the face with something that I never could have predicted from a business that I'd originally started so that I wouldn't have to talk to people. I went from doing small tasks with measurable results, selling more clothes, to abstractions like going on E! News to talk about what's hot or speaking at a conference. I didn't want to talk about my job. I wanted to do my job. But then talking about my job became my job. Even worse, people expected me to be a certain way just because I'd accomplished something. A sizable part of me resented the fact that I had to choose my words carefully. I often wondered, was this a choice? Because it sure as hell doesn't always feel like it. But I did choose it. Even if growing a huge business was never my singular goal, every small choice that I made along the way was something that contributed to where I am now. Every time I got up in the morning, instead of saying screw it and sleeping in, every time I spent a few extra minutes on a product description to make it perfect, I was choosing my fate and sowing the seeds of my future. It's really hard to chart the path that led here, but it happened, and I did it. In my book, and this is my book, magical thinking is the alchemy that you can use to visualize and project yourself into the professional and personal life that you want. I'm not talking about stuff like The Secret self-help book, which basically tells you to tape a picture of a car to the wall and then sit on the couch and wait for someone to drop it off in your driveway. I'm talking about visualization that works when we actually get off our asses and do stuff. How totally crazy is that? Each time you make a good decision, or do something nice, or take care of yourself. Each time you show up to work and work hard and do your best at everything you can do, you're planting seeds for a life that you can only hope will grow beyond your wildest dreams. Take care of the little things, even the little things that you hate, and treat them as promises to your own future. Soon you'll see that fortune favors the bold who gets shit done. Chaos magic. Those who don't believe in magic will never find it. Roald Dahl. Chaos magic is the idea that a particular set of beliefs serves as an active force in the world. In other words, we choose what and how we believe, and our beliefs are tools that we then use to make things happen. Or not. Though this comes from a school of magical thought, it actually seems really practical and no duh to me. It all goes back to the red string of my imaginary kite. If you believe something, other people will believe it too, You can't convince someone else, whether it's a potential employer, a loan officer at the car dealership, or someone you've been crushing on, that you're amazing and terrific if you don't actually think you are. This isn't the false confidence that comes from getting a bunch of likes on your Instagram selfies, but a deep down, unshakable self-confidence that persists even when things aren't going all that great. A big practice in chaos magic is the use of sigils, which are abstract words or symbols that you create and embed with your wishes. To create a sigil, start by writing out your desire in a single word, a couple of words, or a short sentence. Then remove all the duplicate letters, then all the vowels. Basically, you can do whatever you want here, until you're left with a bunch of lines that you can combine into one symbol. Then you put the piece of paper in a book, in your wallet, or some other place where it won't get lost, and just forget about it. The real magic of sigils is that you're only forgetting about it on the surface level. Taking the time to think about what you really want and doing something about it, even if it's just drawing some lines on a piece of paper, embeds these wishes into your subconscious, and then your subconscious makes it happen, even when the conscious part of your brain is busy doing something else. I treat my internet passwords as modern-day sigils, embedding them with wishes or promises to me, or even financial goals for the company. Hey, I never made any claims to be normal here. That way, every time I go to log in anywhere, I'm subtly reminding myself of what I'm working for. This kind of intention setting has worked for me. Dozens of times a day, as I tap out a few strokes on the keyboard, I'm reminding myself of the bigger picture. This ensures that when I'm bogged down with day-to-day bureaucracy and details, I don't lose sight of what I really want. I'm not trying to say that this kind of intention setting will always work, because you can't just type a bajillion dollars whenever you log into Facebook and all of a sudden become Warren Buffett. It is, though, a heretic's version of kneeling by your bed and saying a prayer every night. It's intention setting. It doesn't have to be as hard and fast as saying, I want a job at a fashion company, but it can be something like, I want a creative job, or I want to have fun at work. Keep reminding yourself over and over that this is what you want, and you'll soon find that the more you know what you want, the less you're willing to put up with what you don't. One of the best things about life, a reason not to go blindly after one goal and one goal only, is that sometimes it will take you to something that is way cooler than anything you would have consciously set out to do in the first place. I never had one particular goal or dream that I was working toward. All I knew was that I wanted to do something awesome, and was open to whatever shape or form this awesomeness took. I wanted to be a photographer. I wanted to go to art school. I wanted to play in a band. And when I started the eBay store, all of this came in handy even though I would never have associated these things. My interest in photography gave me an advantage over other sellers who didn't care about lighting or composition. My days of being the tardy employee at the record store gave me a cultural and musical understanding that was more unique than if I just listened to garbagey pop on the radio my entire life. None of these things I ever expected to add up to something called a brand, but they contributed to all the ways in which Nasty Gal is just a little off and a little surprising. All of that flailing about, trying new things, and finding out that I liked some of them and hated others, ended up amalgamating into something very real and very meaningful, and in the end made me capable of providing a life for myself. While I truly believe that you must have intentions to fulfill your dreams, I also think you have to leave room for the universe to have its way and play around a bit. Don't get so focused on one particular opportunity that you're blind to other ones that come up. If you think about one thing and talk about it all the time, you're being too obsessive. You might ruin it. If you let yourself meander a bit, then the right things and the right people fall into place. Some things are worth fighting for. Don't get me wrong, I'm definitely a fighter, but I really think that what is right should be easy. My dad has always said that the definition of crazy is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, and it's so true. If something's not working out, but you keep hammering at it in the exact same way, go after something else for a while. That's not giving up, that's just letting the universe have its way. Treat your thoughts like your dollar bills. Don't waste them. Though I believe in magic, I'm not hippy-dippy, and I generally abhor people who are. I remember I had a hippie friend once who whispered, "The cat can sense the stillness in my soul." And all I could think was, the cat is really going to sense it if I barf because you sound so self-important. That said, if you approach everything in your life with a certain degree of intention, you can affect the outcome. At the absolute minimum, you will affect how you feel about the outcome, and that is ultimately what matters the most. If I am in a shitty mood while making dinner, the food is going to taste like crap. But if I'm in a happy mood while I'm cooking, then dinner is going to be absolutely fantastic. I also think you can end up ignoring, and even losing, the positive things in your life by focusing too much on the negative. That's a huge drain, as well as a waste of time. When you think about people, you give them power. My ex-boyfriend Gary taught me this lesson when we first started dating. This was the heyday of MySpace, when you could always see who was commenting on whose page, so I knew way too much about this one girl, or woman, because she was way older than me, whom he had once hooked up with and was still lurking around. She was my favorite horrible thing to talk about, and I brought her up a little too often. For obvious reasons, this would piss him off. When he finally got fed up with the subject, he said, "I don't think about her, and I don't want to think about her, but when you bring her up, I have to think about her and it makes me uncomfortable. Why are you doing this to me? Why are you doing this to yourself?" Turns out, he had a point. Flashback to Halloween several years ago. He and I were at the Deco Lounge in San Francisco. He was dressed as a monk and was wearing this 100-year-old Masonic robe, which, let's face it, was basically a giant black dress with a skull on it. And I was dressed as a blaxploitation character wearing a halter disco gown and a giant afro wig. Not the most politically correct choice, I realize, but as I've said before, this was San Francisco, and you picked a decade and stuck with it, even in costume. As we were getting ready to go out that night, I mentioned this woman's name again, wondering if we would run into her. It was unlikely, as she lived in LA at the time, but she was known to lurk up north. As soon as we walked into the bar, there she was. She saw Gary, made a beeline for him, and began to whisper in his ear as soon as she was close enough. She totally ignored me, even though I was only inches away and holding his hand. "Hi," I said, interjecting myself into her whisper fest with an introduction. "I'm Sophia." I mustered every molecule of inner goodwill to put a smile on my face. But she just turned and looked at me with a snarl. "Oh, are you his ex-girlfriend?" "No, I'm his girlfriend," I said, no longer caring at all about trying to be nice. "So what are you even doing at this bar at your age anyway?" And that, dear girl boss, was what started the only fight I've ever been in. She pulled my afro off, I punched her in the nose, and Gary dove in between us, pulling her off me as I went at it on the Deco Lounge floor. Though I can laugh at it now, the absurdity of costumes and wigs and punches and a man in a dress breaking it up, it was a miserable Halloween and a miserable night. During the miserable cab ride home, I realized that I'd put so much energy into thinking about what I didn't want to happen that I'd caused that exact thing to happen. I conjured that bitch. I've also had to learn to rein in my negative thoughts when it comes to business competition. Around the same time that I launched the Nasty Gal website, I'd become pretty good friends with another girl who ran a vintage eBay shop. We talked shop, but in a way that I always assumed was friendly banter between two people who had a lot in common and not sharing state secrets. A year after I left eBay and set Nasty Gal up with a proper website, she also decided to launch her own. When her site went live, it looked really wonderful because it looked exactly like mine. The design was exactly like mine. The wording was exactly like mine. Everything was exactly like mine. I'd known she was launching a website, but assumed she had enough class to do something different. I had one phone call with her in which I told her to get some ideas of her own, and we never spoke again. After this happened, I was obsessed with this incident. I talked about it all the time while rolling my eyes and thinking about how much she sucked. Finally, I did this so much that Gary pointed out I was obsessing about her so much that I was going to make her successful. I took this advice seriously and decided then that I don't want to spend time thinking about things that I don't want to have a place in my life. You have to kick people out of your head as forcefully as you'd kick someone out of your house if you didn't want them to be there. Naturally, every boyfriend comes with an ex-girlfriend, every business comes with competitors, but it is entirely up to you to decide how much time you spend thinking about them. Frankly, even if that girl your boyfriend used to make out with suddenly gets hit by a car, like you're secretly hoping she will, who cares? You're still you. The same goes for business. There's no karmic law that dictates your business will succeed if others fail. So why not just wish them well and get on with it? Focus on the positive things in your life, and you'll be shocked at how many more positive things start happening. But before you start to think you just got lucky, remember that it's magic, and you made it yourself. Let your fashion freak flag fly. Chapter 7. I am the anti-fashion. Why fit in when you were born to stand out? Dr. Seuss. As the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre so poignantly put it, hell is other people. While I no longer agree with this sentiment, I can empathize with the guy. When I was about 4 or 5, my parents threw me a birthday party. There was cake, presents, and a piñata. When the time came, I lined up, got blindfolded, spun around in circles, and whacked the poor papier-mâché donkey with a broomstick just like all the other kids. Hitting something with a stick was very gratifying, but I had never seen a piñata before and had no idea that there was any sort of end goal. Therefore, it came as a complete shock to me when another child's final whack knocked the donkey's head off. It split open, spilling its candy guts onto the ground. The sight of Tootsie Rolls and Starbursts turned the other kids into screaming primates, and as they immediately dove for the candy, I stood frozen. I was completely unaware that such a treasure trove even existed inside that piñata. So instead of jumping into the melee to fight for my rights, I turned, ran straight to the nearest table, and promptly crawled under it. And there I stayed until the last sugar-sodden 5-year-old party guest had left, and I felt it was safe to emerge from my cave. 25 years later, I'm still not a huge fan of surprises. This is your brain on introversion. Though it might not seem like it from the outside, I'm actually an introvert. Common knowledge used to dictate that extroverts were outgoing and introverts were shy, and this certainly never applied to me. I'm about as far away as you can get from a shrinking violet. However, research over the last few years has been focused on how the two personality types are actually more defined by what energizes them. Extroverts get their energy from being around a lot of people, but introverts find large groups draining and require time alone to recharge. Introverts and extroverts also process external stimuli via different pathways in the brain, which means that something an extrovert would find completely fun and novel, such as a bunch of kindergartens rioting for candy, would be totally overwhelming to an introvert like me. However, as a kid, you're not self-aware enough to understand why you're different. You just know that you are. Being an only child meant that I naturally spent a ton of time alone. I preferred it this way and was never lonely. Yet at school, this tendency to be alone made me feel weird. It was considered strange to want to be alone on the swings while everyone else was on the jungle gym, even if alone on the swings was where I was happiest. As a result, I spent way too much time thinking about what other people thought about me and what I could possibly do to make them like me more. Do they think my family's house was big enough? Did they think I was pretty? Did they like my backpack? I think it's cool, but what if this backpack makes me look like I'm in 6th grade when I'm really in 7th? Just typing that paragraph makes me exhausted, so I think it was no wonder that by the time I was a teenager, I ended up preferring to make tuna sandwiches at Subway, where at least I could be alone in my head, rather than subjecting myself to the nonstop emotional roller coaster they call adolescence. Introverts are naturally more sensitive because they don't need a ton of dopamine, the feel-good neurotransmitter that your brain produces in response to positive stimuli. Conversely, extroverts can't get enough. They even love adrenaline, the chemical that your brain produces in the face of fear, so they need bigger and riskier situations to produce the same natural high that an introvert gets from just having a conversation with a close friend. Introverts are also more apt to pay attention to the small details, and an eBay store is a treasure trove of small details. Much of the world, from school to the workplace, is set up to reward extroverts, and therefore it can be easier for introverts to feel overlooked or as if they don't measure up. For instance, even if you know all the answers but don't want to call attention to yourself by raising your hand, you might end up feeling or being perceived as less smart than the kids flailing their arms to get the teacher's attention. Same goes for work. Just remember, as Susan Cain writes in Quiet, there's zero correlation between being the best talker and having the best ideas. In business, a disproportionate amount of importance is placed on the ability to network. If you don't thrive on going out and meeting a million people, you might end up feeling that you have less of a chance of getting ahead in your career. Also, introverts might hang back in meetings and thus not be perceived as leadership material, even though introverted people frequently make more empathetic managers. As I've said before, part of the reason that I started Nasty Gal was that I wanted a job where I could be by myself and not have to deal with people. I wasn't great at in-person customer service because I can't fake a smile to save my life, but it turned out that I was really good at it electronically. Over email, eBay, and MySpace, I was a customer service queen, able to respond to people politely and genuinely, infusing everything with a digital smile. Psychologists now believe that social media is a really valuable tool for introverts because it allows them to communicate and even network on their own terms. Even though introverts might keep quiet during meetings, they have several tendencies that actually come in handy in the world of business. They make fewer risky financial decisions. Hello, 1 million in the bank at Nasty Gal. Are more persistent when faced with a problem that isn't easily solvable, and can also be very creative. A lot of the world's great artists, thinkers, and even business people are and were introverts. Albert Einstein, Bill Gates, and J.K. Rowling, to name a few. So in no way does being an introvert doom you into a life in the shadows. Getting off at the wrong stop. I think I got off on the wrong planet. Beam me up, Scotty. There's no rational life here. Robert Anton Wilson. I was once, and still am, a not-so-secret metalhead. I'll admit that sometimes feeling bad feels good. A lot of people poo-poo downer music, but they must just be really well-adjusted. Nothing, for me, feels more comforting than the sound of an angry, misunderstood man. There is a great song, Born Too Late, by a band called St. Vitus that I have always loved. I can still recite some of the lyrics by heart because they're just too good. And by good, naturally, I mean bad. Every time I'm on the street, people laugh and point at me. They laugh about my length of hair and the out-of-date clothes I wear. They say my songs are much too slow, but they don't know the things I know. I have a friend who told me something recently that really resonated. He said that he felt like he'd gotten off at the wrong stop. As if there's a bus traveling through space and time that randomly opens its doors and drops souls off to live through whatever time they're assigned. I don't believe we're all fit for the time we're assigned. It's a weird world we live in, and until time travel exists, we've all got to make the most of where we land. Failure is your invention. Life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. George Bernard Shaw. I gave up a long time ago on finding anything that was 100% totally me. I was not only open to trying on different lifestyles, I forced some experimentation upon myself, always knowing that I'd evolve past it, rarely surprised when I was ready to move on, and never so attached that it hindered my growth. Strangely, I think this attitude paid off when I started the business. From Nasty Gal's inception, I have always viewed the business as a work in progress. I constantly tweak and move on, peeling back layers of the onion as new ones arrive. If something didn't work, like if I put a dress up for auction and no one was bidding on it, I didn't just assume that no one wanted it. I just tried something else. I rewrote the product description or swapped out the thumbnail because I thought that maybe people couldn't judge the silhouette correctly from the original picture I'd posted. I never assumed that I'd just done my best job the first time around. Your challenge as a girl boss is to dive headfirst into things without being too attached to the results. When your goal is to gain experience, perspective, and knowledge, failure is no longer a possibility. Failure is your invention. I believe that there is a silver lining in everything, and once you begin to see it, you'll need sunglasses to combat the glare. It is she who listens to the rest of the world who fails, and it is she who has enough confidence to define success and failure for herself who succeeds. These words were not invented for an incremental life. Success and failure serve a world that is black and white. And as I said before, it's all just kind of gray. This may sound sad or boring, but it's actually quite empowering. It's not the prescription that many books may suggest exists, but it allows you to self-prescribe and to self-subscribe. You belong wherever you want to belong. Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. Oscar Wilde. There's a certain freedom to being an outsider. You do what you want, say what you want, and move on when you've worn out your welcome. In the past 7 years, I've gone from being a nobody with no job and no insurance to someone who is seen as a leader and a role model. I was once told by a big-shot CEO that if I'm in an elevator with employees and chat with one but not the others, it signifies to everyone that the person I spoke to is more important than the others. To put it plainly, I exist under a microscope. It's been rough getting used to the fact that what I say matters, whether it is good or bad, and holy shit, people actually want to talk to me. When we have our all-hands meetings, I'm required to stand in front of 200 people and talk about everything that's happening within the business while simultaneously seeming like I didn't have a bad morning and also possess every answer to the company's problems. I've asked myself, who am I to hold all these other people captive while I blather and make bad jokes? Oh shit, I'm the boss, that's who. Some people become CEOs for this exact reason, because they like to be in the spotlight. But it doesn't come naturally to me, and I don't know that it ever will. I no longer expect anyone to throw a rotten tomato at me and yell, "Off the stage, freak!" But the whole thing is still pretty surreal. I've played with a lot of different lifestyles and identities. When I was living in Olympia, I snuck into a high school prom and danced with the cutest underclassmen I could find. I dressed up like a soccer mom to steal a loaf of bread. Never in my life, though, did I ever imagine that the role that I would actually end up inhabiting was that of a CEO. I felt like a fraud for a long time, as if there was no way in hell I was qualified. Who gave this freak the keys? I thought to myself, wondering if and when I'd ever be found out. I refused to think of people I met through business as friends. My real friends were weirdos from San Francisco who were broke, loved obscure elf metal, and celebrated 6606 with me like it was Christmas. I kept telling myself that Danny, my investor, wasn't my friend, even though we had great conversations over dinner and I loved his wife. I thought that people like Danny couldn't be my real friends because they were from this pedigreed world of MBAs and real careers, whereas I was just an interloper in a Black Sabbath t-shirt. Finally, though, I arrived at a point where I decided this was bullshit. I stopped feeling as if I didn't belong anywhere and realized that I belonged anywhere I wanted to be, whether that was a boardroom, business class, or on stage at a Women's Wear Daily CEO summit. Today, I consider Danny my peer. Sometimes I can even get him to laugh at a fart joke. Nasty Gal has been my MBA. I've learned to not be shy about stopping someone in the middle of a presentation to ask him to please clarify something because I don't know what he's talking about. If I still don't get it, I'll tell him so and ask him to explain it again. Sometimes I can practically hear the eyes rolling around the room. But given that I'm making decisions that involve so much money and so many people, I can't afford to pretend to know what's up. When you run a company the size of mine, you're not the only one who ends up paying for your mistakes. I could act like a CEO, or I could really be a CEO, which means doing whatever I need to do, including asking obvious questions, to make the best decision for my company. No matter where you are in life, you'll save a lot of time by not worrying too much about what other people think of you. The earlier in your life that you can learn that, the easier the rest of it will be. You is who you is, so get used to it. On being a freak. I like being myself. Myself and nasty. Aldous Huxley. When you accept yourself, it's surprising how much other people will accept you too. As a company, Nasty Gal sits half in the fashion world and half in its own galaxy. I've never felt that more acutely than when I go to New York Fashion Week. I absolutely hate Fashion Week. It hurts me from the inside out. Let me break down Fashion Week for you, and I apologize if I am shattering your dreams of glamour and sophistication. You are assigned a piece of bench in a too-hot or too-cold warehouse that is hard to get to because all the cabs are taken and the subway is not a choice due to your absurd-ass shoes. The piece of bench assigned to you is not even as wide as your butt, and someone is probably sitting on it. You are forced to either act like an asshole and confront that someone and tell him or her to move, or you go and put your butt down in someone else's assigned piece of bench, at which point that person will be forced to act like an asshole and come along and tell you to move. At this point, you couldn't care less about the clothes you're about to see. You wish you were back in your hotel room eating glutinous pancakes and wearing sweats. I'm not a blogger, I'm not an editor, and my company doesn't buy luxury brands. So even though I've been written about on Style.com and in such magazines as Elle, whenever I go to a fashion party, I feel like Lindsay Lohan in Mean Girls when she shows up to the Halloween party in a nightgown and buck teeth while everyone else is wearing lingerie and bunny ears. All of a sudden, I revert to being an insecure 13-year-old, wondering if I'm wearing the right brand of shoes and are they the right season? If so, are they the right color? Barf. It's a high school outfit contest, and I'd rather be working. Nasty Gal is anti-fashion, in that we encourage girls to choose what fashion means to them. We aren't just following, and neither are our customers. I'm getting more and more comfortable with one foot in the fashion world and one foot out. As I've gotten to know more people in the fashion industry, it's been refreshing to realize that a lot of them respect me because, as an outsider, I have a unique point of view. Had I tried to fit in, Nasty Gal would have crashed and burned a long time ago. The last thing the world needs is another boring person or another boring brand, so embrace all the things that make you different. Alter your clothes all you want, but don't you dare alter your inner freak. She's got your back as much as I do. Getting what you want even when you no longer want it. Far and away, the hardest thing for me to get used to about Nasty Gal's meteoric rise is that my own profile has risen with it. For years, I prided myself on being anonymous, an expert at the art of avoiding human interaction. But today, I could be walking along picking my nose, grabbing my boyfriend's butt, or trying on lip gloss in Sephora, when suddenly someone sidles up to me and says, "You know, I really love Nasty Gal." There's no way around it. The success of Nasty Gal means that my life has permanently changed. I've been tagged on Twitter by people who saw me going through airport security, running down a mountain in Big Sur, and sitting in the driveway of my own house. I've had people I don't know come up to me at parties and introduce themselves by saying, "Hey, I heard we're neighbors." They're thrilled, but I'm thinking, "Who are you and how do you know where I live?" I once Instagrammed a picture of my poodle Donna without realizing that my phone number was visible on her tag. When I started to get calls and texts from strangers, I was forced into changing the number that I'd had for years. Once, at a meeting with my bank, they gave me a gift. It was a book called Silent Safety, Best Practices for Protecting the Affluent. The book had chapters with titles such as Yacht Security and Surviving a Hostage Situation. I thought it was absurd until it began to terrify me. Holy shit, is this the way I'm supposed to live my life now? I'm not complaining. This is all just stuff that I'm getting used to. For example, it's weird to go through life being congratulated on a daily basis. In a single year, I had a profile in Forbes, was on the cover of Entrepreneur, listed on CNN Money's 40 Under 40, Inc.com's 30 Under 30, and named by Inc. magazine as the fastest growing retailer in the country. Our office has consumed a whole hell of a lot of champagne, but how many bottles can you pop? Remember, girl boss, it's not cool to get drunk on your own success. Portrait of a Girl Boss. Norma Kamali, fashion designer and entrepreneur. When I was young, I was so smart and was sure I could do anything. I was convinced I could be a painter and did everything from intensive life drawing while worshiping Michelangelo to studying art history and painting with a passion. My mother convinced me that painting may not be the best way to earn a living and pay rent. I was very lucky to receive scholarships and grants for my paintings, but also got a scholarship to FIT. There I studied fashion illustration and found my way into design after traveling to London in the 1960s. I opened a store in 1967 and have been in business ever since. I learned early on the motto, "Know thyself." I think if you have a unique point of view and stay relevant and authentic, you will make an impression. You have to be excited and passionate about your ideas to make them work. Chances are it will take 20 of those good ideas before one sticks and has a chance to become real. But a good idea is only good if there is a well-thought-out plan to make it a reality. The most important thing to do is to take risks. The risks are where breakthroughs happen, and big shifts take you to new places and create opportunities. They can be really scary and intimidating, but that means it is taking you out of your comfort zone. All designers look at life through a creative lens and are inclined to create their brand of beauty in their everyday lives. I am happy to say it brings me joy, and I love doing it for others as well. I prefer to be creative first and famous last. My mother told me when I was 11 years old, "Learn how to take care of yourself so that the man you marry is the man you choose to be with, and not just the man who will take care of you." Women have